was going to kill her. Maybe not right away, but he was going to enjoy it. He was sure he knew how the big, gentle giant of a man would react, but Baldurhan didn't know that Jandalar had cultivated that calm and restrained demeanor as part of his need to keep himself under control at all times. He had allowed his temper to get control of him before and knew what he was capable of doing. Jandalar's first thought was, how dare anybody try to harm Ayla? This time it wasn't temper, it was reaction. In an instant, before any of the men even thought of moving, Jandalar took two long steps and was behind Baldurhan. He bent over and grabbed both his wrists and broke his hold, almost broke his arms. Then, letting go of one arm, he spun him around and smashed him in the face with his fist. He was close to hitting him again, but the man slumped over in a daze, blood running down his face from his broken nose. Baldurhan had misjudged Jandalar entirely. He was not only a big man, he was a powerful man with quick reflexes, a man who sometimes had to exert himself to control a spirited stallion. Racer was not a domesticated horse. He was a trained horse. Jandalar had lived with him from the day he was born and taught him, but Racer still had all the natural instincts of an extremely strong and sometimes willful wild stallion. It took a lot of strength to handle the horse, and it kept the man in shape. Baldurhan had doubled the leather cord, which had originally been used to tie his shirt together. It was still hanging loosely around Ayla's neck, but the marks it had made were bright red, even in the dim light of fireplaces that were some distance away. People were belatedly running in their direction. Everything had happened so fast. Several Zelandania, including the first, went to help Ayla, and Jandalar wouldn't leave her side. The people Zelandani first had spoken to about how to deal with Baldurhan had gathered around him as he was lying on the ground. Suddenly, Aramina, the woman who had been raped and whose mate he had killed, kicked him. Then the woman who had lost her daughter after she was held by them and badly mistreated suddenly kicked him too. Then a man who had been badly beaten by the men after watching his mate and young daughter being raped punched his face, breaking his nose again. Baldurhan's other men were trying to back away, but they were all surrounded now, and one of them was punched in the face. There was no stopping the angry crowd now. Everyone who had been subject to the depredations of Baldurhan and his men were giving it back and then some. The crowd had turned into a mob. It had happened so fast, no one knew what to do at first. Then the Zelandania moved in to stop it. Ayla was among them, shouting, "Stop it! Stop it now! You are acting like Baldurhan!" But the people couldn't stop. All their frustrations, their feelings of impotence, humiliation, and powerlessness came out. When the people settled down and looked around, all four men were sprawled on the ground, covered with blood. Ayla bent over Baldurhan to check him. He was dead, and so were two others. One was barely hanging on to life, the one who had asked how he could make reparations. Wolf suddenly appeared and stayed with Ayla, watching the scene closely, a low growl in his throat, and she could tell he wasn't sure what to do. Ayla sat on the ground with her arms around his neck. The first moved beside her. "That's not at all the way I expected it to happen," she said. "I didn't realize there was so much pent-up anger, but I should have."
"Baldurhan brought it on himself," Zelandani first said. "If he hadn't attacked Ayla, Jandalar would not have hit him. Once he was down, the people who had been hurt by him couldn't hold back. They knew he wasn't invincible. I guess there's no need for the hemlock now. I will have to make sure it is disposed of properly."
Everyone was still tense and overexcited. It took a while for most people to understand what had happened. Those who had participated were beginning to feel a range of emotions. Some felt shame for what they had done. Others felt relief, sorrow, excitement, even elation that Baldurhan had finally gotten back what he had given out.
Lavila had kept John-Ayla with her when Wolf ran out of the tent, though she wanted to follow him. Ayla had some of Baldoran's blood on her when she returned, which upset her daughter. She assured John-Ayla that it was not her own blood, but that of a man who was hurt. The next morning, Jondalar went to see the Zelindania, who were both called first, to tell them that Ayla wanted to stay in her tent and rest that day. Her throat still hurt from the attempted strangulation. All the local Zelindania had been discussing how to help the people, whether they should call another meeting or wait until people came to them. As Jondalar walked back, he was aware that people were watching him, but he didn't care, and he didn't hear the comments. Men admired his strength and his speed. His reaction had been so swift. The women just admired him. To have a man like that, so handsome, so quick to jump to his woman's defense, who wouldn't want such a man? If he had heard them talking, he wouldn't have cared. He just wanted to get to his Ayla and make sure she was well and that everything was all right. But after a while, it was the story of Baldoran's attack on Ayla and Jondalar's quick defense that was told several times, not the resulting melee that ended in the beating death of three men and quite possibly a fourth, although Gehenar was holding on to life. The Zelindania had to decide how they were going to dispose of the bodies. It posed a dilemma. They didn't want to honor them in any way. There would be no ceremony. But they did want to make sure their spirits were given back to the mother. They ended up taking the bodies into the mountains and leaving them on the crest of a hill, exposed to every kind of scavenger. The visitors from the nearby caves spent a few more days camped in the field, then began to trickle away to get back into their normal routine now that the excitement was over. They would have many stories to tell about the visitors, the one who was first, and her acolyte, who controlled a wolf and horses, and called up a two-headed snake, and who helped rid them of Baldoran. But the versions of what happened to Baldoran and his gang would likely be different, depending upon what part each person had played in the events. Ayla was getting restless and anxious to leave. She decided it was a good time to finish drawing the bison meat. It would give her something to do, and laid out lines of cordage supported by sticks of wood and built smoky fires in and around them. Insects like gnats were drawn to the raw meat, where they liked to lay eggs that could cause it to spoil. The smoke kept them away and, incidentally, flavored the meat. Then she set about slicing the sections of bison into thin, uniform pieces. Before long, Lavila joined her, then John DeCam and Jondalar. John-Ayla wanted to help, so Ayla showed her how to cut the meat and gave her a section of the corded lines to hang her pieces up to dry. Willemar and his two assistants strolled into camp around midday, quite excited.
"After we leave here, we were thinking it might be a good idea to go south along this river until we reach the southern sea,"
Willemar said.
"After coming all this way, it would be a shame not to see it, and we've been told this is the time to trade for shells. They have many of the small round bead shells and the pretty long dentalia, and some particularly nice scallop shells, even periwinkles, I'm told. We could keep some and trade some to the fifth cave."
"What do we have to trade with them for the shells?"
Jondalar asked.
"I was going to talk to you about that. Do you think you could find some good flint and make some blades and points to exchange for shells? And maybe some of that meat you're drying, Ayla?"
Willemar said. "How do you know this is the time to trade, and about all these shell beads?" Lavila asked.
"A man from the north just arrived. You'll have to meet him. He's a trader, too, and he has some fascinating ivory carvings,"
Willemar said. "I knew a man who made ivory carvings," Ayla said, a little wistfully. Jondalar's ears perked up. He knew that same ivory carver. He was a remarkable and talented artist, and the man to whom he almost lost Ayla. He still felt a lump in his throat at the thought.
I would like to meet the man and see his carvings, and I wouldn't mind seeing the Southern Sea. I'm sure we can work something out in terms of trading. What else would make good trade goods?
He asked.
Almost anything that is well made or useful, especially something unusual,
Willemar said. Like Ayla's baskets, Lavila said. Why my baskets?
Ayla said, a little surprised.
They're just plain baskets, not even any decoration on them. That's just it. They seem to be just plain baskets until you look closely, Lavila said. They're made so well, absolutely tight and even, and the weave is so unusual. The ones that are watertight stay that way for a long time. The looser ones also hold up well. Anyone who knows anything about baskets would pick yours before a showier one that is not made as well. Even your throwaway baskets are too good to throw away.
Ayla blushed a little at all the praise.
I just make them the way I was taught, she said. I didn't think there was anything special about them.
Jandalar smiled.
I remember when we first went to stay with the Mamutoi, and there was a festival where people were exchanging gifts. Tuli and Nezi offered to give you some things that you could give as gifts, but you said you had many gifts you had made to keep yourself busy and wanted to go back to your valley and get them. So we went and got them. I think Tuli, in particular, was surprised at how beautiful and well-made your gifts were. And Talut loved his bison robe. The things you make are beautiful, Ayla.
Now she was blushing bright red and at a loss as to what to say.
If you don't think so, just look at Jun Ayla,
Jandalar said with a grin.
That's not just me. Jun Ayla has a lot of you in her, too, Ayla said.
I certainly hope so, Jandalar said.
There's no doubt the mother used your spirit to blend with Ayla's, Lavila said. You can see it in John Ayla's eyes. They're exactly your color, and that shade of blue is not very common.
So everyone's agreed. We will go to the Southern Sea on our way home,
Willemar interjected.
And I think you should make some baskets, Ayla. You can trade for salt, too, not just shells.
When are we going to meet the man with the carvings? John DeCam asked.
If this is a good time to stop for a midday meal, you can meet him now.
I just have a few more pieces to finish, Lavila said.
We can bring some of the bison with us to cook for our meal or contribute to a community meal,
Jandalar said. Jandalar picked up John Ayla, and they all left with Willemar and walked to the Zelandania-covered shelter. Damoran was talking to a stranger, and Amalana, obviously pregnant and fully aware of how attractive that made her, was smiling at him. He was smiling back. He was fairly tall and well-built, with brown hair and blue eyes and an appealing, friendly face, and to Ayla there was something about him that seemed familiar.
I brought the rest of our traveling group, Willemar said, and began the introductions.
When he started with
Jandalar of the ninth cave of the Zelindanyi,
the man looked puzzled as Jandalar put John Ayla down in preparation for joining hands.
And this is his mate, Ayla of the ninth cave of the Zelindanyi, formerly of the lion camp of the Mamutoi, daughter of the mammoth hearth.
You, I know, the man said, or know of you. I am Kanardi of the Losadunai, and you both stayed with the Losadunai a few years ago?
Yes, we stayed with Laduni's cave on our way back from our journey,
Jandalar said with genuine excitement. Although anyone who made a journey usually met many people, one seldom met them again, or even someone who knew someone a person had met.
We all heard about both you at next summer meeting. You made big impression with horses and wolf, I recall,
Canardi said.
Yes, the horses are at our camp, and wolf is hunting,
Ayla said.
And this little beauty must be addition to family. You she resembles,
Canardi said to the tall blonde man with the vivid blue eyes. It sounded as though he was speaking Zelandanyi with a slight shift in construction and a slightly different accent. But Ayla remembered their languages were very close. He was actually speaking Zelandanyi with some Losadunai, his own language, mixed in.
Willemar said you brought carvings,
John Delar said.
Yes, here examples,
Canardi said. He untied a pouch from his waist ties, opened the top, and poured out several mammoth ivory figures onto an unused platter. Ayla picked one up. It was a mammoth with some extra lines incised on it, whose reason was not clear, so she asked him.
I do not know, he said. They always made that way. These not made by ancients, but made like ancients make, especially by young people who are learning.
Next, Ayla picked up a long, slender figure, and when she looked closely, she knew it was a bird, but a bird like a goose flying through the air. It was so simple, yet so full of life. The next figure was like a lion standing on its hind legs, at least the head was, and the top of its body, and the upper arms seemed to be feline, but the legs were human, and in front of what would be the long underbelly of a cat, if it wasn't standing upright, was a clearly marked, elongated, downward-pointing triangle, the pubic triangle, the unmistakable sign of a female. Though there were no human-like breasts, the figure was a lion woman. The last figure was definitely a woman, though she had no head, just a carved hole through which a cord was strung. The breasts were huge and quite high. The arms ended with the indication of a hand with fingers. The hips were broad and the buttocks large, with the line dividing them sharply incised all the way around to the front, ending with such an exaggerated depiction of a vulva, the female organ was almost diverted.
I think this was made by a woman who has been through childbirth,
Ayla said.
That's sometimes how it feels, like you are being split in two.
You may be right, Ayla. The breasts certainly appear to be full of milk, said the first.
Are you offering these for trade?
Willemar asked.
No, these my own. I carry for luck. But if you want one or more, could get some made,
Canardi said.
If it were me, I would get some extras made to take on trading missions. I'm sure they would trade well,
Willemar said.
Are you a trade master, Canardi?
He had noticed the man did not have a trader's tattoo.
I like travel and trade some, but not trade master,
Canardi said.
Everybody trades, but we have not such occupation as specialty. If you like to travel, you can make it be, Willemar said. It is what I'm training my apprentices to be. This may be my last long trading mission. I'm at an age where traveling is losing its appeal. I'm ready to settle down at home with my mate and her children and grandchildren, like that pretty little one.
He indicated Janela.
Some traders take their mates and families with them, but my mate was the leader of the Ninth Cave and not as free to travel, so I always make sure I bring her something special. That's why I was asking if your carvings were available for trading. But I'm sure I'll find something when we go to the Southern Sea to trade for shells. Would you like to travel together with us? When do you leave?
Canardi asked.
Soon, but not before we see the most ancient sacred site,
Willemar said.
Is good you do. Beautiful cave. Most extraordinary paintings. But I see several times. I go ahead. Tell them you coming,
Canardi said. Chapter 27. The entrance to the cave was quite large, but not symmetrical, and more wide than high. The right side was taller, the left, lower section had a projecting ledge over part of it, creating a sheltered area that offered some protection from rain and from the occasional rain of pebbles that cascaded down the cliff. A cone-shaped mound of gravel had accumulated at the far left end of the cave's mouth, falling from the rock face above, amassing on the ledge and spilling over, creating a scree slope from the base of the cone that continued down the side of the cliff. As a result of the capacious opening, light penetrated to some depth into the cave. Ayla thought it would make a good place to live, but it obviously was not used as such, except for the corner under the ledge where a small fire was burning outside a sleeping shelter. There was little evidence of the things that people used to make their life comfortable. As they approached, a Zelandani came out of the shelter and greeted them.
"In the name of the Great Earth Mother, you are welcome to her most ancient sacred place, first among those who serve her," she said, holding out both hands.
"I greet you, watcher of her most ancient sacred site," the first replied. Jonicol was next. "I am Zelandani of the 19th cave of the Zelandani, and I greet you, watcher of her most ancient sacred site. I am told the images inside this sacred place are quite striking. I have also made some images, and I am honored to be invited to see this sacred site," he said. The watcher smiled.
"So you are a Zelandani image maker," she said. "I think you will be a little surprised at what you see in this cave, and perhaps you will appreciate the artistry more than most. The ancients who worked here were quite skilled."
"Are all the images here made by the ancients?" the 19th asked. The watcher heard the unspoken plea in Jonicol's voice. She had heard it before from artists who came to visit. They wanted to know if they would be allowed to add to the work, and she knew what to say.
"Very nearly, though I do know of a few made more recently. If you feel equal to the task and compelled to do so, you are free to make your mark here. We put no restrictions on anyone. The mother chooses. You will know if you are chosen," the watcher said.
Though many asked, very few actually did feel equal to the task of contributing to the remarkable work inside. Ayla was the next one.
"In the name of the Great Mother of All, I greet you, watcher of the most ancient sacred site," she said, holding out her hands. "I am called Ayla, acolyte to the first among those who serve the Great Earth Mother."
"She's not ready to give up her name yet," was the Zelandani's first thought. Then she grew conscious that the young woman had spoken with an unusual accent and knew she was the person she had been told about. Most of her cave thought that all the visitors spoke Zelandani with what they considered a northern accent, but the way this woman spoke was entirely different. She spoke well, she obviously knew the language, but the way she made certain sounds was unlike anything she had heard before. There was no doubt that she came from a very distant place. She looked at the young woman more carefully. Yes, she thought, she's attractive, but she has a foreign aspect, a different set to her features, a shorter face, wider space between her eyes. Even her hair, it's not fine like so many Zelandani women. It has a thicker texture, and though she's blonde, the shade is distinctive, darker, rather like honey or amber. A foreigner, and yet she is acolyte to the first. It's rare enough for a foreigner to become one of the Zelandania, much less acolyte to the first. But perhaps understandable, since she's the one who can control horses and a wolf, and she's the one who stopped the men who have been causing so much trouble for so many years.
"You are welcome to this most ancient sacred site, Ayla, acolyte to the first,"
the Zelandani said, grasping Ayla's hands. I suspect you have traveled farther to see this sight than anyone ever has.
I came with the rest of...
Ayla started. Then, seeing the smile on the woman's face, she understood. It was her accent. The watcher was talking about how far she had traveled on her journey with Jandalar, and before that from her home with the clan, and perhaps even before that.
You could be right, she said, but Jandalar may have traveled even farther. He journeyed all the way from his home to the end of the Great Mother River, far to the east, and beyond, where he found me, and then back again, before we started on this Dunyer tour.
Jandalar stepped closer at the sound of his name and grinned when he heard Ayla describe his travels. The woman was not young and immature, and not old, but old enough so that she had the wisdom that came from experience and maturity, about the age he used to like women before he met Ayla.
"Greetings, respected watcher of the most ancient sacred site," he said, holding out his hands. "I am Jandalar of the ninth cave of the Zelandanyi, Flintknapper of the ninth cave, mated to Ayla of the ninth cave of the Zelandanyi, who is acolyte of the first, son of Marthona, former leader of the ninth cave, brother of Joharan, leader of the ninth cave, born to the hearth of Dalinar, leader and founder of the Lanzadanyi." He recounted his important names and ties. It was one thing for members of the Zelandania to simply state their primary affiliations, but it would seem too casual and not very courteous for him to be so brief in a formal introduction, especially to a Zelandani.
"You are welcome here, Jandalar of the ninth cave of the Zelandani," she said,
taking his hands and looking into eyes of an incredibly vivid shade of blue, eyes that seemed to see inside her very spirit and cause her womanhood to quiver. She closed her eyes for a moment to regain her internal balance. No wonder she's not ready to give up her name yet, the watcher thought. She's mated, and to one of the most fascinating men I have ever met. I wonder if anyone is planning a mother festival for these visitors from the north. Too bad my time for serving as watcher is not up yet. If someone needs me here, I can't go to mother festivals. Willemar, who was waiting to introduce himself to the watcher, ducked his head to smile to himself. It was a good thing that Jandalar hardly seemed to notice the impact he still had on women, he thought. And as perceptive as she was, Ayla seemed oblivious to it. Even though it was discouraged, he knew that jealousy still lived in the hearts of many.
"I am called Willemar, master trader of the ninth cave of the Zelandanyi," he said when his turn came. "Mated to Marthona, the former leader of the ninth cave, who is the mother of this young man. Though he was not born to my hearth, he was raised there, so I think of him as the son of my heart. I feel the same about Ayla and her little one, John Ayla."
She's not only mated, she has a child, a young child, the watcher thought. How can she even think of becoming a Zelandani, much less as an acolyte to the most powerful Zelandani on earth? The first must see a lot of potential in her. But inside, she must be pulled so many ways. Only these five visitors would be going into the cave at this time. The rest of the visitors would go another time and might not see as much. The caves that watched over the sacred site didn't like too many to go in at one time. There were torches and lamps near the fireplace. That was part of the watcher's job, to gather and prepare them so they would be on hand when needed. Everyone took a torch. The watcher handed out extras, put more of them in a pack, and added some stone lamps and small bladders of oil. When everyone had a fire holder to light the way, the watcher started in. There was enough daylight coming into the entrance chamber to get a sense of the huge size of the cave and a first impression of its disorganized character. A chaotic landscape of stone formations filled the space. Columns of stalactites, once attached to the ceiling, and their stalagmite mates had dropped down as though the floor had fallen out from under them. Some tipped over, some collapsed, some shattered. There was a sense of immediacy in the way they were strewn about, yet everything was so frozen in time, they were iced with a thick caramel layer of glistening stalagmitic frosting. The watcher started humming as she led them toward the left, staying close to the wall. The rest followed in single file, with the first next in line, then Ayla, followed by Jonakol and Willemar, with Jondalar at the end. He was tall enough to see over the heads of the rest and thought of himself as a sort of protective rear guard, though he had no idea from what they needed to be protected. Even well into the cave, there was still enough light coming in from the entrance that it was not entirely dark. Instead, the cave was suffused with a kind of deep twilight, especially once eyes became accustomed to the shadowed ambience. As they moved inside and passed by with their lamps or torches, the coloration of the stone the light illuminated varied from thin new icicles of pure white to lumpy gray stumps hoary with age. Flowing draperies hung from above, striped along the folds in shades of yellow, orange, red, and white. Shining lights of crystal caught the eye, reflecting and amplifying the meager light, some glittering off the floor, covered by a white film of calcite. They saw fantastical sculptures that kindled the imagination and colossal white columns that glowed with translucent mystery. It was an utterly beautiful cave. In the vague light, they reached a place where the space seemed to open out. The sides of the chamber disappeared, and in front of them, except for a gleaming white disk, the emptiness seemed to go on and on. Ayla felt that they had entered another area that was even larger than the entrance chamber. Though the ceiling was hung with strange and magnificent stalactites that resembled long white hair, the floor was unusually level, like the calm, still lake it once was. But now the floor of the huge chamber was cluttered with skulls and bones and teeth, and the shallow depressions that had been the beds of hibernating cave bears. The watcher, who had been humming continuously, started increasing the volume of her sound until the intensity and force of the droning was louder than Ayla, who was standing beside her, would have thought possible for anyone to make, but there was no reverberation. The noise was swallowed by the immensity of the empty space inside the stone cliff. Next, the one who was first started singing the mother's song in her deep, rich, operatic contralto. Out of the darkness, the chaos of time, the whirlwind gave birth to the mother sublime. She woke to herself, knowing life had great worth. The dark empty void grieved the great mother earth. The mother was lonely. She was the only. From the dust of her birth, she created the other, a pale, shining friend, a companion, a brother. They grew up together, learned to love and to care, and when she was ready, they decided to pair. Around her he'd hover, her pale, shining lover. She was happy at first with her one counterpart. The first hesitated, then stopped. There was no resonance, no echo coming back. The cave was telling them that this was not the place for people. This space belonged to the cave bears. She wondered if there were any images in the empty room. The watcher would know. Zelandani, who watches over this cave, she said formally, did the ancients make any images in the room ahead?
No, the woman said. This room isn't ours to paint. We can go into the room in spring, just as they often go into our place in this cave. But the mother has given this room to the cave bears for their winter sleep."
"That must be why people decided not to live here," Ayla said. "When I first saw this cave, I thought it ought to be a good place to live, and wondered why a cave had not chosen it. Now I know."
The watcher led them to the right. They passed by a small opening that led to another chamber, and a little farther on came to a larger opening. Like the entrance chamber, this one was a chaotic mass of fallen blocks of stalagmites and concretions. The pathway went around these obstructions and led to a vast space with a high ceiling and a dark red floor. A promontory created by a huge cascade of stone dominated the chamber, marked by several large red dots on a rock pendant suspended from the ceiling. They came to a large panel, a nearly vertical wall that continued up to the ceiling, covered by large red dots and various signs.
"How do you think these dots were made?" the watcher asked.
"I suppose a big wad of leather or moss or something similar could have been used," Jonicol said.
"I think the Zelandani of the 19th should look a little more closely," the first said.
Ayla remembered that she had been here before and no doubt knew the answer. Willemar probably knew, too. Ayla did not volunteer a guess, nor did Jondalar. The watcher held up her hand and stretched back her fingers, then held it up to a dot. It was just about the same size as her palm. Jonicol peered at the large dots. They were a bit blurry, but he could see faint impressions of the beginnings of fingers extending up from some of the dots.
"You're right," he said. "They must have made a very thick paste of red ochre and then dipped their palms in it. I don't think I have ever seen dots made that way."
The watcher smiled at his amazement and looked rather pleased with herself. Seeing the smile made Ayla notice that the area they were in seemed to be more well lit. She looked around and realized they were close to the entrance again. They could have come this way in the beginning instead of going around by way of the extensive bare sleeping room, but she was sure the watcher had her reasons for going the way she did. Next to the large dots was another painting that Ayla could not decipher except for the straight line of red paint above it, with a cross piece near the top. The path led them around the blocks and concretions in the center of the room until they came to the head of a lion painted in black on the wall opposite. It was the only black painting she saw. Near it was a sign and some little dots, perhaps made with a finger. Somewhat farther on was a series of palm-sized red dots. She counted them in her mind, using the counting words. There were 13. Above them was another group of 10 dots on the ceiling. But in order to make them, someone had had to climb up on a concretion with the help of some friends or apprentices, she supposed, so they must have been important to the maker, although she could not imagine why. A little farther on was an alcove. A lobe of rock at the entrance was completely covered with the large red dots. Inside the alcove were more red dots on one wall, and on the opposite wall a group of dots, some lines, and other markings, and 3 horse heads, 2 of them yellow. Within the central mass of blocks and stalagmites opposite the alcove, the watcher pointed out another sizable panel of large red dots behind some low concretions.
"Is there an animal head made of red dots in the middle of those dots?" Jonicol asked.
"Some people think so," the watcher said, smiling at the image-making Zelandani for seeing it.
Ayla tried to see an animal, but she only saw dots. She did, however, see a difference.
"Do you think these dots were made by a different person than the other dots? They seem bigger."
"I think you are right," the watcher said. "We think the others were made by a woman,
these by a man. There are more images, but in order to see them, we need to go back the way we came."
She began humming again as she led them into a small chamber within the central concretions. A large drawing of the front part of a deer was painted there, probably a young Megaserus. It had small palmate antlers and a slight hump on the withers. While they were there, the watcher raised the volume of her humming. The chamber resonated, crooned back to them. Jonicle joined in, singing scales that softly harmonized with the watcher's tones. Ayla began whistling bird songs that complemented the music. Then the first started singing the next verses of the mother's song, toning down her strong contralto so that it just lent a rich, deep, intense note to the singing. She was happy at first with her one counterpart. Then the mother grew restless, unsure in her heart. She loved her fair friend, her dear compliment, but something was missing. Her love was unspent. She was the mother. She needed another. She dared the great void, the chaos, the dark, to find the cold home of the life-giving spark. The whirlwind was fearsome, the darkness complete. Chaos was freezing and reached for her heat. The mother was brave. The danger was grave. She drew from cold chaos the creative source. Then, conceiving within, she fled with life force. She grew with the life that she carried inside and gave of herself with love and with pride. The mother was bearing. Her life she was sharing. The dark, empty void and the vast, barren earth with anticipation awaited the birth. Life drank from her blood. It breathed from her bones. It split her skin open and sundered her stones. The mother was giving. Another was living. Her gushing birth waters filled rivers and seas and flooded the land, giving rise to the trees. From each precious drop, more grass and leaves grew, and lush, verdant plants made all the earth new. Her waters were flowing. New green was growing. The first stopped at a place that felt like an ending to the impromptu chorus. Ayla stopped, too, at the end of an extended melodious trill of a skylark, leaving Jonicle and the watcher, who finished on a harmonizing tone. Jondalar and Willemar slapped their hands on their thighs in appreciation. "That was marvelous," Jondalar said. "Just beautiful."
"Yes, that sounded quite good," Willemar said. "I'm sure the mother appreciated it as much as we did."
The watcher led them through the small chamber, then down to another recess. From the entrance, the head of a bear painted in red could be seen. As they crouched down to get through a low corridor, more of the bear came into sight, and then the head of a second one appeared out of the darkness. Once they were through and could stand, they could see the head of a third bear, lightly sketched under the head of the first one. The shape of the wall was skillfully used to add depth to the first bear, and although the second bear seemed to be complete, it was a hollow in the place of the hindquarters that gave that impression. It was almost as though the bear was emerging from the spirit world through the wall.
"Those are definitely cave bears," Ayla said. "The shape of their forehead is so distinctive. It's like that from the time they are little."
"Have you seen little cave bears?"
"Yes, occasionally. The people I grew up with had a special relationship with cave bears," Ayla said.
When they stood at the back of the niche, they could see two ibexes partially painted in red on the right wall. The horns and the backs of the animals were formed by the natural fissures in the rock wall. They went back through the corridor and climbed back up to the level of the deer, then followed the left-hand wall until they reached a large open area. As they walked around the chamber, Jonicle looked into a niche that held an ancient concretion with a top in the shape of a small basin. He took his water bag and poured a little water in it. They went back out the way they went in and finally reached the large opening that led to the bear's sleeping room. Not far from the entrance of the cave, on a big rock pillar that separated the two chambers, opposite the other paintings in the room full of chaotic rock formations, was a panel some 20 feet long by 10 feet high that was covered in large red dots. There were other markings and signs, including the straight line with a crossbar near the top. The watcher led them through the opening into the bear's sleeping room again, following the left wall. She stopped just before an opening.
"There is much in here, but I wanted you to see certain things,"
the Zelandani said, looking directly at Ayla.
"First,"
she held up the torch she was carrying. There were some red marks on the wall that appeared to be random lines. Suddenly Ayla's mind filled in the gaps, and she could see the head of a rhinoceros. She saw the forehead, the start of the two horns, a short line for its eye, the end of its muzzle with a line drawn for the mouth, and then the suggestion of its chest. It startled her in its simplicity, yet once she saw the animal, it was clear.
"It's a rhinoceros,"
Ayla said.
"Yes, and you will not see any others inside this room,"
the watcher said. The floor was hard stone, calcite, and the left wall was blocked by white and orange-colored columns. Once past the columns, there were almost no concretions, except for the ceiling, which held strange rounded stone shapes and reddish deposits. The floor was full of pieces of stone of every size that had fallen from the ceiling. A somewhat circular area was broken by the fall of a heavy fragment from above, which caused a tilt in the floor. Near the entrance, on a rock pendant, was a small rudimentary sketch in red of a mammoth. Beyond that, high up on the wall, was a small red bear. It was apparent that the artist had to climb up the wall to paint it. Below it, on a rock sticking out of the wall, were two mammoths that utilized the relief of a rock wall, and beyond it, on another protrusion, was a strange sign. On the opposite wall was an extraordinary panel of red paintings, which included the forequarters of a well-made bear. The shape of the forehead and the way the head was carried identified it as a cave bear.
"Jonicle, doesn't this bear look very much like the red bear we just saw?"
Ayla asked.
"Yes, it does. I suspect it was made by the same person," he said.
"But I don't understand the rest of the painting. It's like two different animals joined together, so that it seems to have two heads, one of them coming out of the chest of the bear. But then there's a lion in the middle, and another lion head in front of the bear. I don't understand this painting at all,"
Ayla said.
"Perhaps it is not meant to be understood by anyone but the one who made it. The artist used a lot of imagination, and may have been trying to tell a story that is not known anymore. There are no elder legends or histories that I know of to explain it," the first said.
"I think we just have to appreciate the quality of the work,"
the watcher said,
"and let the ancients keep their secrets."
Ayla nodded agreement. She had seen enough caves now to know that it wasn't so much how the images looked when they were done as what the artists accomplished while they were making the art. Farther into the gallery, beyond the second lion head and a fault in the wall, was a panel painted with black, the head of a lion, a big mammoth, and finally a figure painted high above the floor on a pendant hanging from the ceiling. It was a large red bear, its back outlined with black. The mystery was how the artist painted it. It was easily visible from the floor, but whoever made it had to climb over many high concretions to reach it.
Did you notice that all the animals are going out of the room, except for the mammoth? Jonicle said. It's as if they're coming into this world from the place of the spirit world.
The watcher stood just outside the room they had been in and started humming again, but this time it was similar to the melody of the music of the mother's song, the way the first sang it. Every cave of the Zelandanyi sang or recited the mother's song. It told the story of their beginnings, of the origin of the people, and while they were all similar and told the same story, each cave's version was not exactly the same. That was especially true if they sang it. The melodies of the songs were often quite different, sometimes depending on who did the singing. Because she had been endowed with such an extraordinary voice, the first had composed her own unique way of singing it. As if on signal, the first picked up the next verse of the mother's song from where she left off. Both Jonicle and Ayla refrained from joining in and just enjoyed listening. In violent labor, spewing fire and strife, she struggled in pain to give birth to new life. Her dried, clotted blood turned to red ochred soil, but the radiant child made it all worth the toil. The mother's great joy, a bright, shining boy. Mountains rose up, spouting flames from their crests. She nurtured her son from her mountainous breasts. He suckled so hard, the sparks flew so high, the mother's hot milk laid a path through the sky. His life had begun. She nourished her son. He laughed and he played, and he grew big and bright. He lit up the darkness, the mother's delight. She lavished her love. He grew bright and strong, but soon he matured, not a child for long. Her son was near grown. His mind was his own. She took from the source for the life she'd begun. Now the cold, empty void was enticing her son. The mother gave love, but the youth longed for more, for knowledge, excitement, to travel, explore. Chaos was her foe, but her son yearned to go. He stole from her side as the great mother slept, while out of the dark, swirling void, chaos crept. With tempting inducements the darkness beguiled. Deceived by the whirlwind, chaos captured her child. The dark took her son, the young, brilliant one. The mother's bright child, at first overjoyed, was soon overwhelmed by the bleak, frigid void. Her unwary offspring, consumed with remorse, could not escape the mysterious force. Chaos would not free her rash progeny. But just as the dark pulled him into the cold, the mother woke up, reached out, and caught hold. To help her recover her radiant son, the mother appealed to the pale, shining one. The mother held tight and kept him in sight. The sound resonated. The song echoed back to them, not as strongly as some, the first thought, but with interesting nuances, almost as though it was doubling back on itself. When the first reached a place in the verse she felt was appropriate, she stopped. Silently, the group continued on. On the right side of the cave, they came to a large accumulation of stalagmitic stone along with collapsed blocks. This time, the watcher took them to the left side of the cave at the deepest part of the bear's sleeping room. Across from the stalagmites and stone blocks was a large rock pendant in the shape of a blade hanging from the ceiling. The stones defined the beginning of a new chamber with a high ceiling in the beginning, but decreasing toward the back. Many concretions hung from the roof and the walls, unlike the bear's sleeping place, which had no such concretions. When they reached the hanging pendant, the watcher knocked her torch against an edge of rock to make it burn cleaner, then held it up so the visitors could see the surface of the panel.
Closest to the bottom, facing left, painted in red, was a spotted leopard. Ayla and Jondalar and Jonicol had never seen a leopard painted on the walls of a sacred site before. Its long tail made Ayla think it was probably a snow leopard. At the end of the leopard's tail was a thick flow of calcite, and on the other side of it was one large red dot. No one understood the reason for the large red dots in this place, or even what the leopard meant. But there was no doubting that it was a leopard. The same could not be said about the animal above it that faced right. The massive shoulders and shape of the head could almost be mistaken for a bear, but the thin body, long legs, and spots on the upper body made Ayla sure it was a cave hyena. She knew hyenas, and they had massive shoulders. The shape of the head in the painted animal somewhat resembled that of a cave bear. The powerful teeth and jaw muscles of a hyena that could crack the bones of a mammoth had developed a more powerful bone structure, too, but its muzzle was longer. The coat of a hyena was stiff and coarse, especially around the head and shoulders.
"Do you see the other bear above it?" the watcher said.
Suddenly Ayla caught sight of another figure above the hyena. In faint red lines, Ayla could make out the distinctive shape of a cave bear facing left, in the opposite direction of the hyena, and she began making comparisons.
"I don't think the spotted animal is a bear. I think it is a cave hyena," Ayla said. "Some people think so, but its head is so bear-like," the watcher said. "The heads of the two animals are similar," Ayla said, "but the hyena in the image has a longer muzzle and no discernible ears. The tuft of bristly hair on the top of its head is typical of a hyena."
The watcher didn't argue. People had a right to think what they wished, but the acolyte had made some interesting observations. The woman then pointed out another cat that was hidden on a narrow panel on the underside of the hanging stone, and asked her what kind of cat she thought it was. Ayla wasn't sure. There were no distinctive marks on its coat, and it was elongated to fit the space, but it was very cat-like. On second thought, maybe weasel-like. There were some other animals that she was told were ibex, but they weren't as clear to her. They were then led back to the left side of the chamber. At first, there were many concretions, but no drawings. As they continued down the passage, they came to a long panel. A calcareous formation had decorated the wall with draperies and strings of red, orange, and yellow that didn't quite reach the thick conical mounds beneath them. Concretions, like rivulets frozen in time, seemed to run down the hanging drapes, leaving spaces between them on which strange signs had been painted. One was a sort of long rectangular shape with lines coming out the sides. It reminded Ayla of a very large depiction of one of those creeping creatures with many legs, perhaps a caterpillar. In a space next to it was a shape that had something like wings on either side of the center. It could have been a butterfly, which was the next stage in the life of a caterpillar. But it wasn't as carefully done as many of the other paintings, so she wasn't sure. She thought of asking the watcher, but doubted if she knew. Whatever she said would only be her guess. As they continued, the wall became less extravagantly decorated. The watcher started softly humming again. There was some resonance, but not much, until they came to an area with overhanging rock. There, clusters of red dots had been made. It was followed by a frieze of 5 rhinoceroses. There were other signs and animals in the area, 7 heads and 1 complete cat-like animal, perhaps lions, plus a horse, a mammoth, a rhinoceros. Several positive images of handprints, plus dots forming lines and circular figures. Further on were more signs and a sketch of a rhino in black. Next they came to another blade of rock,
a kind of partition on which were more signs, a partial outline of a mammoth in black with a red negative hand stencil inside the line of the body, and another on the flank of a horse. To the right of them, two clusters of large dots. On the other side of the panel of hand stencils was a drawing in red of a little bear. There was also a red deer and some other marks, but the bear was the predominant figure. It was drawn very much like the other red bears they had seen, but it was a miniature version. The panel marked the beginning of a small chamber straight ahead. As they looked in, they could see that it had little headroom.
"I don't think we need to go in here," the watcher said. "It's just a very small space without much in it, and we'd have to stoop or crouch once we were inside of it."
The first agreed. She had little desire to squeeze herself into a tiny space, and as she recalled, there wasn't much in it. Besides, she knew what was coming and was more anxious to see that. Instead of going straight ahead to visit the small chamber, the watcher turned left, then followed the right wall. The next chamber was about 5 feet lower than the one they were in. The floor was slanted down, the ceiling was high in places and low in others, and the walls and ceiling had many concretions. There was some evidence that cave bears had been there, paw prints, claw marks, and bones. Ayla thought she saw the hint of a drawing some distance away, but the watcher just walked through, not bothering to point it out. The space felt like an entryway to something else. The entrance to the next chamber was low. In the center of the next room was a sinkhole, a depression that was about 30 feet around and over 12 feet deep. They passed around the right of it on a floor of brown earth.
"When did the floor collapse?"
Jandalar asked. The floor underfoot seemed solid enough, but he wondered if it could happen again.
"I don't know," the watcher said, "but I do know it was after the ancients were here."
"How do you know that?"
Jandalar asked.
"Look above the hole,"
she said, pointing to a smooth, blade-like pendant of rock descending from the ceiling over the hole. Everyone looked. Because the surfaces of most of the walls and descended ceiling rocks in this chamber were coated with a soft layer of light brown clay-like material, vermiculite, a chemical alteration of the mineral constituents of the stone that softened the surface, the images were white. Drawings, engravings of a sort, could be made with a stick or even a finger, displacing the brown-colored surface clay and leaving a pure white line underneath. Ayla noticed that there were many white drawings in this room, but on the overhanging rock she could clearly see a horse and an owl with its head turned around so that its face could be seen over its back. It was something owls were known to do, but she had never seen a drawing of it. She had never seen any owl drawings in a cave.
"You are right. That had to be made by the ancients before the floor collapsed,"
Jandalar said,
"because no one could reach it now."
The watcher smiled at him and enjoyed the incredulity in his voice. She pointed out several more of finger-etched drawings in the large room. She took them around to the other side of the circular depression, the left wall. Although it was filled with hanging pendants of stalactites and stalagmitic pillars and circular pyramids built up on the floor, it was not difficult to move around in the room, and most of the decorations were at eye level. Even at a distance, the light from their torches showed many white engravings, some scraped to produce a white surface. Standing in the middle of the room, they could see mammoths, rhinoceroses, bears, aurochs, bison, horses, and a series of curved lines and sinuous finger marks drawn over bear claw marks.
"How many animals are in this room?" Ayla asked.
"I have counted almost twice 25, the watcher said, holding up her left hand with all her fingers and her thumb bent at the knuckles, then opening her hand and closing the knuckles again.
Ayla remembered the other way to count with fingers. Counting with hands could be more complex than the simple counting words if one understood how to do it. The right hand counted the words, and as each word was spoken, a finger was bent. The left hand indicated the number of fives counted. The left hand, held palm facing out, with all the fingers and thumbs bent at the knuckles, counted not five the way she had taught herself when she first learned to count, and the way Jandalar had once taught her the counting words, but 25. She had learned this way of counting in her training, and the concept had astounded her. It made the counting words so much more powerful when used like that. It occurred to her that the large dots could be a way of using the counting words, too. One handprint could be counted as five. One large dot, made with only the palm of the hand, could mean 25. Two would be twice 25, 50. And so many on the wall in one place would be a very large number if one understood how to read it. But as with most things associated with the Zelindania, it was probably more complex than that. All signs had more than one meaning. As they were walking around the room, Ayla saw a beautifully made horse, and behind it two mammoths, one superimposed on the other, with the line of their bellies drawn as a high arch, which made Ayla think of the massive arch outside. Was the arch supposed to represent a mammoth? Most of the animals in this chamber seemed to be mammoths, but there were many rhinoceroses, too. One in particular captured Ayla's attention. Just the front half was engraved, and it seemed to be emerging from a crack in the wall, emerging from the world behind the wall. There were also a few horses, aurochs, and bison, but no felines or deer. And while almost all of the images in the first part of the cave were made with red paint, the red ochre from the floor and walls, the images in this part were white, engraved with fingers or another hard object, except for some made with black on the right wall at the end, including a beautiful black bear nearby. They looked interesting, and she wanted to go see them, but the watcher led them around the left side of the large crater in the middle of the room toward another section of the cave. The left wall was hidden by a rocky mass of big blocks that she could barely make out in the light of the torches, which reminded her to knock off the excess burned ash of her torch. The light flared up, and she realized that she would need to light another torch soon. The watcher began humming again as they approached another space defined by a much lower height, so low that someone had climbed up on the blocks and drew a mammoth with a finger on the ceiling. On the right was the head of a bison, quickly done, followed by three mammoths, then several more drawings on rock pendants hanging from the ceiling. Ayla could see two big reindeer drawn in black and shaded to give them contours, and less detailed, a third one. On another part of the pendant, two black mammoths faced each other, but only the forequarters of the one on the left were made. The one on the right was filled in with black, and it had tusks, the only tusks she had seen on the mammoths in this cave. There were other drawings on pendants farther back, quite a distance above the floor, another mammoth engraved in left profile, a big lion, and then, surprisingly, a muskox identifiable by its down-curving horns. Ayla had been so involved in trying to see the animals on the pendants in the back that it wasn't until she heard the first join in that she realized the watcher, the first, and the Zelindani of the 19th cave were singing to the cave again. She didn't join in this time. She could make bird and animal sounds, but she couldn't sing. But she did enjoy listening. She welcomed him back, her lover of old, with heartache and sorrow, her story she told. Her dear friend agreed to join in the fight, to rescue her child from his perilous plight. She told of her grief and the dark, swirling thief. The mother was tired.